Hello, and welcome to Pod Emperor of Dune. I'm Elaine, a longtime sci-fi fantasy fan, reading Frank Herbert's classic science fiction Dune Saga for the very first time. I'm joined by my co-host Alex, who is tackling his first reread. Join our chapter-by-chapter deep dive into the series, as I make wildly incorrect predictions, Alex tries not to give anything away, and together, we learn to walk without rhythm.
Hello and welcome back to Pod Emperor of Dune. I'm Alex here, as always, with Elaine.
Hey guys.
Today we're going to be diving into chapters 13 and 14 of Children of Dune, and then we're going to get started with our first predictions of children.
I predict that there will be children in this book.
Well, there already are children in this book, so a little belated with that prediction. No points for that one. Anyway, you want to get started with our first epigraph today?
Mm-hmm. So this epigraph is from the Lado commentary, after Hark al-Adda. So, continuing with the mystery of who or what Hark al-Adda is.
Mm-hmm.
It reads, "A sophisticated human can become primitive. What this really means is that the human's way of life changes. Old values change, become linked to the landscape with its plants and animals. This new existence requires a working knowledge of those multiplex and cross-linked events, usually referred to as nature. It requires a measure of respect for the inertial power within such natural systems. When a human gains this working knowledge and respect, that is called, quote, being primitive, end quote. The converse, of course, is equally true. The primitive can become sophisticated, but not without accepting dreadful psychological damage." I have to disagree with this point and say that there is nothing inherently special or mentally protective about living a more rural versus urban lifestyle, but it is certainly true that it is good for one's mental health to have some connection to and ability to interact with nature, but I certainly object to the premise that living a more quote-unquote sophisticated versus primitive lifestyle is inherently psychologically damaging.
Yeah, but from a perspective, they're viewing, you know, like the city life and going away from being like in the desert and becoming water fat and all these things as being like, you know, becoming more sophisticated and less Fremen and therefore psychologically damaged.
Yeah, it's just we don't know what perspective this is written from. It right. might not be written from a Fremen perspective, for example, although it does seem
that's the spin
like
that
it seems clearly
to have.
Alludes to the Fremen and that perhaps they became more primitive as this describes when they were chased onto Arrakis from wherever they initially came from, which presumably was more civilized or sophisticated.
Mm-hmm. But it's definitely putting that primitive lifestyle in a better light than the sophisticated one.
Mm-hmm. Even though typically one would consider that sophisticated is a good thing, the way mm-hmm. those words are usually used, like perhaps the denotation is not so clear cut, but the connotation certainly is that sophisticated has kind of a good connotation to it and primitive typically bad.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, perhaps we'll eventually learn more about the Hark al-Adda and their perspective. That might give us some kind of retroactive insights into some of these epigraphs, but for now, we still remain in the dark.
Right.
All right, so in the chapter itself, we start with a discussion between Lado and Ghanima about a dangerous plan to obtain more information without resorting to the even more dangerous plan of a spice trance. So they want to avoid having to go quite that far, but they're still going to have to take some risks to get more information.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, what they're planning to do is to allow their ancestral memories of their parents to kind of take them over, like temporarily, with Lado embodying Paul and Ghanima embodying Chaney. It turns out that this is something they used to do with some frequency when they were younger, but haven't done it in quite some time, at least in part because it has become harder to come back to themselves, especially for Ghanima. Apparently, women find it easier to take on their ancestral personas, but the flip side is that it is harder for them to send the personas away and take control of their bodies back.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess they're kind of more susceptible to possession generally, which perhaps is part of why Aaliyah found herself so easily taken over.
Yeah, and based upon what we know from the last chapter with Aaliyah, this is certainly a dangerous premise
mm-hmm.
for yeah. what the twins are about to undertake.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that they just, like, casually did it when they were little.
Yeah.
Also, what a weird thing to, like, role play as your parents, basically.
Yeah, that is kind of weird, especially since they're siblings.
Yeah. Definitely strange. And underlining the risk, we'll see by the end of the chapter that Ganima, in fact, comes very close to becoming a Chaney-possessed abomination.
Right.
So, definitely correct to be concerned about the risk. So the two of them are sitting in a hidden place up above the desert where their parents used to go, and they're arguing about whether or not they should actually go through with it. Leto is really the one pushing for it, because he's very self-righteously convinced that it's the only path forward, while Ganima is much more cautious of the dangers and wants to think through all the possibilities before committing to a particular path. Leto threatens to go through with the quasi-possession alone if she won't help him, arguing that they need both guidance and protection from the root of abomination that Aaliyah has so clearly gone down. He thinks they need to act decisively and use the knowledge of the past to face the future head-on. Ultimately, Leto does prevail in convincing her, although she isn't very happy about it, and he kind of strong-arms her into it, like, if you don't help me, I'll do it myself, and if something happens to me... Like, the implication is, if something happens to me because you weren't there to help, it'll be your fault.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's a bit manipulative, but it works for him. So, they sit next to each other, and she puts her arm around him while she sings a song that Chaney had often sung for Paul. As noted before, Ganima slips more easily into the persona of Chaney, while Leto must work a bit harder at becoming Paul, even briefly becoming distracted by the memory of Paul's father, his namesake Duke Leto. But he eventually succeeds, and then Paul as Leto speaks with Chaney as Ganima. Paul says that his last vision has not yet come to pass. We never do learn exactly what this vision entails, or why it is described as his last vision. Is it just the last one that he had before knocking Chaney up that hadn't come true yet? Is it the one that takes place furthest in the future? It's obviously not the last vision he actually had, because I'm pretty sure he had visions while Chaney was pregnant, and Leto wouldn't have access to any of those.
Mm-hmm.
So I was a little bit confused about what this last vision thing meant.
Maybe it was the last, like, true vision he had before he was too clouded by the tarot to be able to prophesize things effectively.
Maybe. But I feel like he was having visions late into the novel.
Well, he at least had the one vision that he was holding on to so he could still see.
Mm-hmm.
And he had that weird vision with the moon.
Oh my god.
Although, that not chapter. To bring up a sour topic. I know we both hate the fucking moon vision, but those are like the only two I can think of that we had access to in Messiah, right? Because at the beginning, the tarot was already a thing, and
yeah.
There was already issues with like having prescience. So I'm assuming this is like the last legit vision he had before the tarot became a problem for him.
Yeah, I couldn't tell if it was something like that, where it was like the last vision that he had, or it was like the last vision in terms of like sequence, like the farthest out vision that he'd had, like the thing that is was furthest in the future that still hadn't come to pass.
Mm.
So I wasn't sure what exactly it meant, and we don't get any clarity on it.
Yeah, well, one thing's for sure. It must be a vision that he had prior to spermal separation.
Yes, which is what my note about was it the last vision he had before knocking up Chaney, because anything after that, the twins wouldn't know about.
Exactly.
So yeah, we don't really find out about what exactly this means, but there is some vision that Paul had that Leto has access to, because his memory of Paul has access to it, that has not yet occurred.
Mm-hmm.
So, Memory Paul and Memory Chaney have an intriguing discussion regarding whether Paul could actually be the preacher. Obviously, since both are just memories from before their respective fates came to pass, they have no knowledge of what Paul actually did afterwards. And Memory Paul acknowledges that he might actually be the preacher, mysteriously alluding to the idea that his last vision could have been reason enough for him to stay alive, although to do so, he would have had to go to Jakarutu, an idea which horrifies Memory Chaney. In response, Memory Paul replies that the mythos of Muad'Dib must be totally destroyed so that this child can bring us back from chaos, as he puts it. By this child, I am assuming he means the child he is currently inhabiting, Leto, although why Leto and not Ganima, not clear.
Mm-hmm.
Because he specifically says this child, not these children. And this bringing back from chaos that he refers to appears to be something related to his last vision called the Golden Path, which, despite its name, Chaney describes as not a good vision. So that seems ominous. And in the rest of this chapter, we learn that the Golden Path is something that Leto intends to follow based on the memory of this last vision that his father had.
Right.
We get very little clarity about what the Golden Path is or what it means or why it's called that or anything.
Mm-hmm.
But we do learn from Leto's later discussions with Ganima that that's what he's set on doing. Memory Paul counters that even if the vision is not a good one, it is the only possibility for some reason. Memory Chaney seems to imply that this was not always the case, but since Aaliyah has been such a disaster and Jessica came back to Arrakis far too late to help her, it is the only path left. So even though she thinks it's a bad path, she seems to agree that it is the only one.
Mm-hmm. So it seems that there might have been some sort of other timeline they could go down that would involve, like, a good version of Aaliyah somehow, but I'm assuming that they're assuming that she's too far gone with this abomination business that she isn't usable for any kind of good future path that would be an alternative to this golden path.
And or because she's been possessed for so long, she's managed to fuck things up so much that...
Oh yeah, true.
It's now this or nothing. And it's just like, if only anyone had ever tried to help Aaliyah and considered doing anything to prevent this outcome rather than just leaving a child to its own devices. Something that also is happening basically with the twins, like Jessica finally has shown up, but maybe if she was really concerned about preventing them from being abominations, she could have come back a little earlier.
Yeah.
It's just the Bene Gesserit is like, oh, the abomination shouldn't exist, but we're going to do zero things to intervene to prevent them from becoming abominations.
Yeah, especially considering how much the Bene Gesserit hate abominations. It's really strange that Jessica's just showing up now.
Yeah. Like, I understand being afraid of them, but the fact that she hasn't even, like, killed them or something or imprisoned them in some way, do anything to mitigate their threat while at the same time not trying to help them if you wanted to go in that direction. They just have done nothing.
Yeah.
Anyway, Memory Chaney asks if perhaps another path could be found, so an alternative to the Golden Path, if Leto could look into the future, but Memory Paul explains that this is not possible for him, at least not yet. Unclear if it means that he wouldn't have the ability to see that far or that specifically if he did look into the future, or simply that he hasn't undergone the spice trance yet and hasn't had enough experience to have visions of the future because he's concerned about abomination.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they're just relying on what this Paul memory knows.
Yeah, relying on the memory of a vision, which seems, like, based on what we knew from the first book, where everything was pretty probabilistic and the possibilities of what could happen changed significantly over time based on decisions, I wonder how accurate this vision is now. If it's a vision from at least, like, 10 years ago.
Yeah, you'd have to think it's pretty outdated at this point.
Yeah. And it doesn't update in real time, obviously. So mm-hmm. I feel like, I don't know.
Unless this vision included specific events that have happened. Like, certain things would need to happen in a certain way in the future. Like, if Aaliyah became an abomination, like, within a certain time frame, and Jessica showed up too late to solve that, and, like, some other things. Maybe, like, it was a vision that had branching paths, and this is one of the paths. Like, everything that's happened kind of lines up.
I guess that could be true, but if that is the case, then I would really have to fault Paul for not doing anything to deal with Aaliyah. Because if he did see that whole chain of events with Aaliyah becoming an abomination, the golden path becoming necessary, and he's like, this seems like a bad outcome, but I'm still going to walk out into the desert, allow this to happen to my sister, and do nothing to prevent it. That seems pretty, well, both shitty from a sibling perspective, but also from a planning perspective.
I almost feel like this whole Aaliyah becoming an abomination and nobody dealing with it in the large amount of time they had to deal with it leading up to it is kind of a plot hole. You know, yeah. Why didn't anyone deal with it?
And I mean, I know it probably happened when she was closer to 15 or 16, like basically right after Paul left or a couple months after Paul left, but that's still a long time you could have had to intervene and, like, help her build up her mental defenses or, like, do anything.
Yeah, I'd be curious if any listeners have any thoughts on that, because I can't really pinpoint any particular reason why, you know, like, what's the excuse? There doesn't seem to be much of an excuse to not have, you know, this dealt with in some way
at
prior
the very
to Abomination.
Least, Jessica.
Mm-hmm.
I find that very strange.
I mean, maybe you could say that Jessica and, like, the Bene Gesserit by extension, or I guess the Bene Gesserit and Jessica by extension sort of felt that abominations were lost causes, so they didn't want to deal with an abomination, and maybe Paul sort of prioritized
using her as a prophetess.
Well, not using her as a prophetess. I was going to say,
like, to the people, I mean, not obviously.
During the events of Messiah, sort of prioritized needing to deal with the conspiracy and preserve his bloodline was sort of, like, higher.
But she was 15 by that point. There was many years before that.
Yeah, she was 15.
And I can see that Bene Gesserit not having intervened during Aaliyah's childhood or during the events of Messiah because, you know, Paul kind of told them to fuck off, and I can see them not wanting to mess with the Emperor's family. I just find it weird that Jessica and Paul wouldn't have supported her.
Yeah.
And even if she didn't ask them for help, like, they're not stupid. They know what she is. They know what she's vulnerable to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Jessica has ancestral memories. Paul has ancestral memories of what abominations are because Leto and Ganima do. So they both have access to those things. And the fact that they were like, well, we'll just let this child deal with it on her own and hope for the best seemed like a bad plan.
Yeah.
Again, it's the kind of thing that I feel like a throwaway line of, you know, Jessica having a thought of when I left her, I thought that I had trained her well enough to build up her mental defenses or something like that. Just of like a, oh, I thought it would be fine because I thought I had done enough or that I did something or whatever. Or I advised her through my letters about how to build up her mental defenses. Or just like some hint of like, I gave a fuck about this problem.
Yeah, I still think there is either a missing chapter from Messiah or a missing flashback chapter at the beginning of this that would be like in the timeline of Messiah. Or even like you have Leto with Paul in his brain. Like Paul could talk now and say, you know, reiterate some sort of event that happened in the past where he tried to help Aaliyah, but there's just nothing.
Yeah, that's true. I think listeners know our thoughts on this point by now. Yeah. But this is the story that we have, and we'll continue with it. Okay, so at this point, Leto becomes aware that Memory Paul is finding it difficult to resist the temptation to possess him and again return to living flesh. But Leto cries out to him, and Paul slowly and effortfully begins to release his hold. Although he stops again upon hearing Chaney speak and ask what is happening. Leto wants them to hold on a little bit longer to learn more, and he asks Memory Chaney to tell them how to resist what has happened to Aaliyah. Instead of Chaney, Memory Paul actually answers him, saying that there is no certain way, given Aaliyah's fall to the Baron. Leto is afraid and asks if the Baron is within him as well. Memory Paul confirms that he can feel him lurking there sometimes, but explains that the ancestral memories can't always read Leto's thoughts, and that Memory Paul would not be able to tell whether Leto had ever been infected with the Baron's influence. He also explains that the more precise the ancestral memory, the more dangerous it is, and men who love to seek power at any cost are the most precise and are stronger than other memories. Of course, that would include the Baron, although I would argue it would also to some degree include Paul. Leto offers to allow the memory of Paul to possess him to prevent the Baron from ever taking him over, but Paul refuses, pointing out that regardless of who is doing the possessing, abomination is still abomination. And Leto appreciates the effort that he knows Memory Paul's refusal must take.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is an opportunity for Paul to basically come back from the dead.
Mm-hmm. We could have two Pauls running around. But yeah, it's kind of actually crazy that Leto just is like, hey, take me. Like, they spent all this time worrying about abomination. He's just like, it's fine, Dad. Just take me over. I don't need to exist.
Yeah, where's your sense of self-preservation, Leto?
I mean, I realize it's out of fear of being possessed by something worse. And he's like, well, I'd rather it be Paul than the Baron. But at the same time, like, dude, this is like quite an offer you're making. And fortunately, his memory of his father is strong enough to resist that temptation. Leto is appropriately spooked by this whole experience and comes back to himself. Although he finds himself fighting a very strong temptation to take spice and look into the future the way his father had. However, he knows that doing so would be a misery, as all the future would be known to him, and there would never be anything different or surprising. Apparently, Paul's last vision, this golden path, offers a way to escape this so-called trap, although again, we don't really get any information on how or why. Also, like, don't know that... I feel like the definition of prescience shifts a lot from, like, the first book to this. Where in the first book, there were at least a couple of instances in which the visions were not enough to reveal everything that was going to happen.
Mm-hmm. You get bits and pieces, but not the full picture.
And, like, things still happen that surprised Paul, but Leto here describes it as if you would know literally everything that would happen and nothing could ever surprise you again and whatever. And just every time I feel like I have a handle on how the prescience works, I feel like we get a new definition of it.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. A little confusing. But I guess it would, you know, reveal a lot of things that would happen. So perhaps he doesn't mean literally nothing would ever surprise you again, but just a lot fewer things could, and that would make life more unpleasant. Anyway, before any of that, Leto has another problem to deal with. While he and Paul were able to sort themselves out, Chaney is really putting up a fight at the idea of letting Ganeema come back to herself. Leto argues with the memory of Chaney as she tries to convince him to allow Paul to take over and let them live second lives together, which is gross in terms of, yeah, like, the bodies they'd be using.
Let's use our children's child bodies and live a second life.
Gross. I hate it. I hate it. But I suppose from the perspective of a memory of a dead person trapped in someone's head, any port in a storm.
I suppose so.
Leto argues back with her that he would hate her and it would turn them both into abominations, and that Paul himself would hate her. This last point about Paul hating her does seem to start making an impact, and he repeats it with the voice. Leto tells the memory of Chaney that if they allowed it to happen, Paul would despise her so much that he would walk out into the desert to die again, which is quite a threat. If you made us do this, I'll commit suicide in front of you just to avoid being with you. Uh-huh. Chaney still fights, but Leto keeps telling her to leave, and eventually Ganeema herself is able to reason with her mother and come back to control her body. At one point, asking Chaney if she would create a second Aaliyah. But it takes literally all night to convince Chaney to step down. Throughout all of this, Leto is pretty panicked, and he is angry with himself for talking Ganeema into doing this against her doubts, recognizing that the female ability to access their ancestors so easily is also the root of the Bene Gesserit's fears about abominations. Obviously, since the Bene Gesserit are all female, presumably all previous abominations have also been female. And these female preborn are particularly susceptible to being abominations. Maybe male preborn would be less likely to be susceptible to that happening.
Mm-hmm.
But the Bene Gesserit don't have experience with that, and they've primarily dealt with female preborn who just often become abominations because they so easily fall into their ancestral memories or whatnot.
Yeah, or I guess to put it a different way, their ancestral memories just won't let go once they're in control.
Mm-hmm. At any rate, when Ganeema awakens, Leto apologizes profusely, but she moves on and says that it's fine because they both learned a lot. So that's a pretty blasé reaction to almost being taken over by your dead mother. But I guess she survived. So one thing that she's learned is that while she's not happy about it, based on what Chaney has told her, Ganeema now agrees that they must follow Leto's golden path. They then discuss Jessica's motives for returning to Arrakis, and how they can't let their ancestral memories of Jessica and their pre-existing knowledge about her color their perceptions and interpretations of her actions now, because obviously their memories of who she was are pretty outdated.
Mm-hmm.
Because they basically end at Paul's birth.
Right. Yeah, she could have changed quite a bit as a person since then.
She definitely has. So at least I think that's what they're saying about Jessica. Two of them aren't speaking very directly about things, as often happens, but I'm pretty sure that the idea is that they can't let what they already know about Jessica color the way they see her actions now.
Right.
They aren't sure if Jessica has completely returned to the Bene Gesserit, and they discuss the motives of the Bene Gesserit and the search for the Kwisatz Haderach, suggesting that Jessica could be an instrument in persuading the Bene Gesserit to give up on and abandon the Atreides twins, perhaps just recognizing that they're not going to get control of them and to stop scheming about them.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, another alternative is that the Sisterhood will want to mate the twins together to preserve the bloodline. At this point, I kind of think the Bene Gesserit has a brother-sister incest fixation, given their scheming in the previous book.
They certainly do have an incest obsession.
Like, I recognize that it's for purely scientific purposes, and like, I mean, that's, you know, it's what we do in science. You specifically inbreed mice so that they all have the same traits and you can compare them to each other. But with humans, it's quite different, and it's just, ugh, so gross. Not to mention that if you do, like, multiple generations of inbreeding, you are just asking for bad recessive traits to pop up. And Paul's already inbred.
Yeah, I guess they just think it's worth it to produce what they're trying to produce.
Yeah. Fortunately, Both Leto and Ganeema seem pretty against this incest idea. They agree that the power of the Kvisatz Haderach must fail. Although Leto caveats this by saying that it must fail at least as far as the Bene Gesserit being able to use it, he seems less determined that it fail altogether.
Maybe he needs to utilize it in some way.
Mm-hmm. Or he has the Kvisatz Haderach powers or whatnot. Maybe they both do, I don't know. And he doesn't want to. Take themselves off the board, just prevent it from propagating further, maybe. So, their ordeal finished, they get up to return to the siege, with Ganeema acquiescing to the fact that they must follow Leto's golden path. Ominously, Leto uses one of their ancient languages to say, "We will accompany each other into deathliness, though only one may return to report it." They agree that it is an extremely dangerous and delicate plan that could, and possibly should, result in one of their deaths. They are using very cryptic language here that is only somewhat explained, in which it is implied that even if one of them did not die, they would be so changed that it would be as if they had. So, that doesn't bode well.
Also, fun fact, I did do a little bit of research, and the language they're speaking is ancient Egyptian.
I thought it might be. I forget what exactly tipped me off, but there was something in the description of the language that I feel like made me think that it was Egyptian, potentially. It is cool that he used an existing language, though.
Yeah, definitely cool.
And yeah, I would assume that 10,000 years later or whatever, or 20,000 years later, I guess more, however many years, plus like another 5,000 years, people are probably not still speaking ancient Egyptian. Although it is interesting that it suggests that their memories go back that far.
Yeah.
Ganeema's thoughts indicate that her brother is working on convincing her not only that the golden path is, in fact, the necessary and correct course, but also that she allow him free rein to carry out the extremely dangerous myth creation which the plan generated. She worries about this, seeing what has become of the cult of Muad'Dib under the poor leadership of Aaliyah, and the power of a militarized priesthood with Fremen backing. Though, I'm not gonna lie, I don't think the cult of Muad'Dib was great even before these specific problems arose.
No, it definitely had its faults.
Cults in general, bad idea.
Yeah.
Murder cults especially bad, but cults of personality also not awesome.
Let's just avoid cults.
Yeah.
Seems like a good plan.
This podcast is officially anti-cult. Taking a stand. At any rate, Ganeema is concerned that Leto has seen more in his visions than what he is telling her, and that he perhaps truly wants to become a deity-like figure like their father had. She knows he isn't telling her everything. She recalls what he has told her about his dreams. Basically, he has dreams where he is out in the sand in a bright light, which is coming from him. This is representing his golden path, which initially makes him think that he is the sun. But he isn't, because instead he is a stick figure holding a very detailed scepter. Then the scepter moves, and he realizes that he is wearing armor, which he can feel but not see, and it gives him the power of 10,000 men. So I don't know what to make of this, especially the stick figure thing. I found that particularly odd.
Yeah, it's kind of a strange dream.
I mean, sure, it's symbolic and it'll probably make sense in retrospect.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of see it as being like, maybe this is what it is. Because obviously the sunshine thing is the golden path, as they're saying. But he is the stick figure I sort of see as him being like a normal average person. You know, sort of like just a featureless random person, and I guess the scepter is some sort of power, whether that's prescience or something else, because it's like heavily detailed and changes who he is as a person. So maybe that's what it's alluding to. I'm not sure.
And then he somehow gains the power of 10,000 men.
Mm-hmm.
So I assume we'll come back to this later, but for now it is kind of just a cryptic dream.
I certainly hope we come back to it later.
Otherwise it would just be a weird thing to include. So Ganeema again voices her doubts to her brother, saying that perhaps this golden path is just as good or bad as any other path. So we don't know what this path is, but her doubts make me very much wonder what it entails. Leto argues that he must do it, and she counters that they could already be possessed and just not know it. So perhaps the golden path is simply a desire of abomination.
Mm-hmm.
Leto disagrees, coming up with yet another reason that Aaliyah has succumbed to abomination while they will not. She resisted her ancestral memories too hard, basically. So eventually they were too much for her defenses, and she was overwhelmed. She can't even understand the secret ancient languages that Leto and Ganeema use, because she refused to reach back so far into herself to learn such things, fearing possession. On the contrary, the twins have tried to find a balance, integrating their memories into themselves, and rather than putting up walls that could be eroded over time, they kind of accepted, while keeping at a reasonable distance, the influence of their memories. They kind of ride the tide and have already amalgamated many of the memories and personas into themselves. Of course, as we just saw, that still doesn't make them immune if they put themselves in a dangerous situation.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like that thing about trees being flexible or brittle, and maybe Aaliyah put up a very brittle wall that was like a harsh wall that wouldn't bend at all against any incursion, and so then eventually it broke and just snapped, and then she had no protection, whereas the twins have a more flexible barrier up that can kind of be pushed back and forth a little bit, but won't break as a result.
Right.
Who knows if that's the case, but that certainly seems to be what Leto's arguing here. Leto asks whether Chani is still a strong force within Ganeema, clearly concerned for her after the events of the previous night. Ganeema says that she is, but they seem to have come to an understanding, and now Chani is working to protect her instead of taking her over. And Ganeema is no longer afraid of listening to Chani's voice. Leto says that he spoke to their father, but he thinks the advice that he got really comes from their grandfather, the late Duke. Not really sure why he thinks this, but that's what he says anyway. Ganeema asks whether this advice includes telling Jessica about the Golden Path. Leto thinks about it and ultimately concludes that he won't. Though he seems to think that her loyalties to the Sisterhood, which could be dangerous, might be vulnerable to undermining due to their shared Harkonnen heritage and her own access to ancestral memories. Although, interestingly, Ganeema is a little disdainful of Jessica's shallow, reverend mother abilities compared to the powers of a preborn, I guess.
Mm-hmm. A little bit of pride there, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Ganeema suggests that perhaps she'll tell Jessica about the Golden Path, with the implication that Jessica might be able to put a stop to it if she knows about it. Leto protests, while Ganeema counters that the universe needs no more Atreides gods. And while Leto agrees, he also says they have to do it anyway or be responsible for the consequences. Ganeema is still fearful about the plan, and while she was convinced to join Leto's plan by her ancestral memories, she is also afraid of the strength she is giving to those memories by using their information, with only her own will and her mother's persona to protect her. She is especially afraid because she knows that without Leto having been there to argue with Chani from Paul's perspective, she would probably be possessed right now. She also knows that Leto needs her help to succeed with this plan, and she also knows that he's hiding things from her, although she doesn't doubt his sincerity that he believes it's the best plan.
Hmm.
So Kanima's got a lot of complicated feelings about this, where she logically understands that it, based on the information she has now, is the best path forward, but she's worried about what Leto's not telling her, and is worried that they're maybe missing a better alternative.
Yeah, so she's just relying heavily on her trust of Leto in this case.
Yeah, which he's not necessarily doing a great job of rewarding, I guess, because he's definitely keeping things from her, and he almost got her possessed.
Yeah, and as was alluded to before, he could even be possessed now and we wouldn't know.
Yeah.
So she's putting a lot of trust in him.
Mm-hmm. Leto acknowledges that the twins will be tested, mentioning possibly by spice consumption and certainly by the trial of possession in the desert. Apparently, this is one of the things he had been keeping from her, and she leaps on it, demanding to know whether this is something that he saw in a dream. So he kind of fucked up and let that slip, even though he'd clearly been keeping it secret from her before. He is unable to deny that they will experience it and that he did see this, but he insists that they will not be possessed as long as they create this golden path. We don't get much info about this ritual, but it is apparently an ancient and dangerous Fremen ritual that could leave them insane or presumably possessed. Ganeema again reluctantly commits to the golden path, but oddly insists that she won't bear Leto's children, which normally I would hope would go without saying. Leto fortunately agrees that this is not a part of his plans.
Well, good.
Yeah. I thought they had established that before, but I guess we need to reiterate it. They then change the subject to Aaliyah, with Ganeema suggesting that it might solve some of their problems to just have her killed before she can cause more trouble. Leto is doubtful that anyone could actually pull this off, although Ganeema notes that there are rumors about Aaliyah and Javid. Leto also seems to doubt that Duncan is being cuckolded, although I'm not sure if that lines up with what we saw in the Aaliyah chapter last episode, which seems like it happened a while back, and that Aaliyah may have been, like, sleeping with Javed for the past 10 years.
Yeah, which, again, seems bizarre. That's why it was, like, really throwing me off, like, when that chapter, or, like, that part of that chapter took place, because it just, it seems strange that Aaliyah would be having this, like, 10-year affair with Javed.
Yeah, I mean, maybe she wasn't actually sleeping with him for most of it. Maybe she was kind of just stringing him along.
I don't know, the Baron was pretty adamant about, like, let's get in his pants.
That's true, so that I can stab him mid-intercourse. Ugh, gross. Anyway, hopefully that timeline gets maybe cleared up at some point. At any rate, Leto also doesn't think it would solve their problems to kill Aaliyah, and insists they must do things through his plan. Ganeema sighs that her way would be cleaner, but Leto understands that she is back on his side and is suppressing her many doubts about this plan. Interestingly, this doesn't really make him happy, which seems like another ominous indication that this golden path is something of a misnomer. So, a lot of mystery about what they're planning and what the golden path is and what this vision was and all of this, but everyone seems pretty nervous about it and that it's not an altogether good thing. So it's maybe the least of all evils, but it's certainly still an evil, is the impression that I'm getting.
Right. So, yeah, we don't have a lot of information on this. Do you have any, like, wrap-up thoughts on this? Or is it kind of like you can't really piece anything together yet because we just don't know enough yet?
Yeah, it's mainly my interest is piqued, but we don't get very much information about what the plan is. So I think it's kind of a read and find out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do like what Frank did here with the... They were, like, speaking in a different language, and I thought that, like, few paragraphs was done pretty well. I know Frank sometimes, like, throws things like that in there, and it can be kind of hit and miss. I thought this was a hit rather than a miss. But yeah, with the Golden Path stuff, I think the same thing you do at this point. It's just not clear what's going on. It was interesting to see this possession thing happen with Paul and Chaney coming in here and seeing how difficult it was for Chaney to, you know, accept that she shouldn't be possessing her daughter.
Yeah. Kind of unexpected. I mean, the Baron totally makes sense, but I mean, I guess being a disembodied memory in your child's head is a kind of terrible existence, so maybe it just kind of drives you crazy if you're not careful.
Yeah.
Or just the, like, you think it's fine, but then you have the experience of being in the flesh again, and it's just really hard to let go.
Yeah, I can imagine that would be the case.
All right, so this epigraph is also another allusion to our favorite epigraph mystery. Testament of Arrakis by Hark Alada. So, seems to be a person.
Mm-hmm.
Although I feel like other epigraphs seem like it's not.
Yeah, because what if you had just by Hark Alada and after Hark Alada?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it could be something that was written after the death
or her death or whatever, yeah. I guess that's true. Okay. So the epigraph reads, "This was Muad'Dib's achievement. He saw the subliminal reservoir of each individual as an unconscious bank of memories going back to the primal cell of our common genesis. Each of us, he said, can measure out his distance from that common origin. Seeing this and telling of it, he made the audacious leap of decision. Muad'Dib set himself the task of integrating genetic memory into ongoing evaluation. Thus did he break through time's veils, making a single thing of the future and the past. That was Muad'Dib's creation embodied in his son and his daughter."
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just talking about Paul's prescience and how he sort of, like, embraced that for the first time in history and utilized it as a force to build something, whether or not it was a good or bad thing that he built. He definitely changed the course of history and shifted society in a different direction based on his ability to view the past and view the future.
Yeah, I guess I just don't really get that. Like, I really don't understand what viewing the past has, like, what his ancestral memories and stuff has to do with prescience at all.
I guess just understanding, like, I mean, he was trying to run a government, right? So if you can view the past and see how different governments were run in the past, you can have more insight into that, I guess.
You can read a fucking book.
You could, but it's different from viewing the memories of people who were involved.
Maybe. I don't know. I don't find it super convincing that, like, ancestral memories would give you any special, like, prescience abilities.
Oh, I would think it definitely would. It would basically give you the experience of tons of people who were able to do things. I mean, you can learn a lot more.
But how does that impact your ability to see the future?
That's the other side of it. I'm saying they're two different things.
I don't see how they're related.
They're two different things.
The epigraph seems to be saying that his ancestral memories gave him the ability to, like, a better ability to see the future, and that's what differentiated him from any other previous prescience or, like, navigators or something.
Well, maybe the combined experience of the past and being able to use that to interpret things about the future that you wouldn't otherwise be able to interpret.
Maybe. I mean, have there never been prescience before? Like, the Bene Gesserit have never had a prescient woman who became a reverend mother?
I'm not sure. I mean, it seemed from the first couple books like they didn't do that much with prescience on the Bene Gesserit side. It was more like other memory that they had through the reverend mothers.
But they somehow got Paul. Like, there must be prescient genes in there somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I guess... this is another one of the epigraphs that I don't really like.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't mind this one that much. I think there's definitely some ponderous ones that are very hard to figure out, but I think this one is a little bit more straightforward. It's talking about the future and the past and Paul being able to view those, and then obviously the embodiment of, you know, that through his children. His children have all these memories they can see in the past, and now they're trying to do this thing with the golden path, so...
But they are not seeing the future. Well, Leto is a little bit, but not deliberately.
Right. They're at least trying to create the future based on things they're able to see that...
Based on, like, a 10-year-old vision, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't... For some reason, this epigraph just really annoyed me.
Interesting.
I guess I feel like any of the epigraphs that are, like, hero-worshipping Paul or Leto, I find generally annoying.
Huh.
I guess.
Interesting.
Because they're just clearly propaganda-y,
mm-hmm.
and I hate that. I don't know.
Yeah.
I find it irritating. I guess it was mildly annoying for the ones in Dune, but because they were kind of all part of a narrative, I guess, that we were getting from Irulan's perspective, and we saw different versions and could kind of compare the propaganda-y ones to less propaganda-y ones, it was kind of an interesting perspective. But these, I don't know, I don't really feel like this gave me any... useful information.
Okay, fair enough.
All right, let's dive into the chapter, which has nothing to do with prescience, really, as far as I'm aware.
Yeah, this is also, like, it would have made more sense if this epigraph was tied to the last chapter, not this chapter.
Happens pretty often, I know.
Yeah, it does. It's kind of strange.
All right, so I really did, in contrast to the epigraph, I did enjoy this chapter, because we finally get to meet mysterious Fradin.
Right.
Who is walking through the gardens of the Carino estate on Seleucus Secundus with our Sardaukar friend Tychonic.
Yep.
From the Sardaukar's thoughts, we learn that Faradin is nearly 18 and is becoming more and more like his grandfather every day, and fortunately, from Tychonic's perspective, less like his mother.
Definitely a good thing.
Mm-hmm. However, Faradin is also like his grandfather in that he is more invested in his own hobbies and interests than in ruling anything, outright saying that he has doubts about the whole throne thing. Tychonic tells him that he will have to make a choice, and Faradin feels frustrated. However, he doesn't seem at all opposed to undermining the Atreides, as he is in fact interested in the sandworm cultivation experiments that he hopes could undercut the Atreides' spice monopoly, and he also doesn't seem that concerned about the plan to have the Atreides twins murdered. He doesn't seem to have any specific antipathy towards them, and in fact, he has slight regret at the idea that they'll be killed, but mainly because he hears that they are interesting people rather than any specific qualms about murdering 10-year-olds. He just views assassinations of royalty as a pretty expected part of life, which is a pretty jaded view and also a blasé way to look at child murder. He assumes that they're going to be poisoned. So perhaps when Cisha and Tychonic aren't actually keeping the plan from him, just specifics like, we're going to have these children torn apart by wild animals because even a jaded prince might find that a bit too horrifying. I really thought that Faradin would be a lot younger than 17 based on the way the two of them were speaking about him in that previous chapter, where the way they were talking made it seem like he was much younger. Like, I would have expected that he was, like, 10 or 12, not 17.
Yeah, I guess it's probably the type of thing where, like, when Cisha is a really sheltering mother and sort of, like, views him as her baby, kind of.
Yeah, because she was talking about, like, oh, we can't tell my sensitive son these things. So yeah. I was just picturing him as more of a child. So I was a little bit surprised that he was as old as he is.
Seems like the type of mom to give him a curfew when he's still living at home at 23.
Ferodin asks Tyakinik if they would have to move to Arrakis, and the Sardaukar acknowledges that it would be best to move to where the action is. Then Ferodin gets to what he really wants to talk about. Tyakinik's surprising recent conversion to the religion of Muad'Dib, as was planned in that previous chapter, to Tyakinik's displeasure. Ferodin seems perceptive enough, as he finds it rather unusual, and he has also noticed that his mother is weirdly happy about it. And he assumes that she thinks the religion will be useful in getting Ferodin onto the throne somehow. So yeah, he's basically got her number on that one.
Yep, seems like a pretty smart kid so far.
Tyakinik explains this away as best as he can by saying that the religion speaks to him as a warrior, and that if Ferodin looks into it, he'll understand why Tyakinik now follows it. Ferodin is skeptical, given that it's the religion of Muad'Dib, the enemy of the Carinos, but Tyakinik avoids answering directly. Ferodin then asks why Tyakinik has asked him to walk in the gardens, and I have to say it's for what was quite an unexpected reason to me as the reader. Though it's obviously a subterfuge, Tyakinik tells Ferodin that he's done something that Wensisha won't like, clearly hoping to trigger the teenager reaction of, well, if my parents don't like it, then it must be cool. Allegedly, as part of his recent conversion, Tyakinik has brought an oneromancer, or dream interpreter, here to interpret Ferodin's dreams. Ferodin is pretty suspicious about this, as this is apparently very un-Tyakinik-like behavior, but Tyakinik pleads his religion and tries to explain that Muad'Dib's religion is able to reconcile all opposing things, such as science and faith, church and state, past and future, but that the only places where such things are irreconcilable are in the beliefs and dreams of men. Ferodin doesn't really believe this, but finds the word somehow compelling, regardless, although he notes that Tyakinik sounds somewhat reluctantly sincere, clearly picking up on the man's misgivings about this whole fake conversion thing. Ferodin doesn't really seem to believe that his dreams actually mean anything, because they're just dreams, but he agrees to the interpretation, partly to satisfy Tyakinik and partially despite his mother. So that bit of their plan worked pretty well.
Yeah, I guess so.
Fuck you, Mom. I will talk to the strange man that Tyakinik brought here. So, what was surprising to me is that the Carinos have not brought just any Oneiromancer here, but in fact, the Preacher himself. Apparently part of Wensisha's plan to involve her son more deeply in the Fremen religion. Tyakinik warns Ferodin that the Oneiromancer is blind, and will therefore be wearing a mask that conceals his face, but allows him to sort of see with his skin somehow. Certainly it makes sense that if we assume that the Preacher is actually Paul, it would be important for him to conceal his face rather than risk someone from the ex-imperial family, perhaps who have studied the Atreides, recognizing him.
Yeah, and this mask is interesting, the seeing through the skin.
Yeah, there's not really much explanation for what it means.
Other than it's a Tlolaxu product, so I guess we can kind of just expect that it's, you know, some sort of fancy technology we'll never understand, but it just works.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe it's some sort of, like, I guess I was envisioning it being a sort of echolocation thing, where, like, sound waves would bounce off stuff around you and, like, I don't know, softly vibrate or something against your face so that you could interpret that somehow as the layout of what's around you, because that's the only thing I could really think of how you would be able to see with your skin.
I don't think there's a scientific explanation for this.
Fair enough.
Nice attempt, but...
So Tyakinik goes off to retrieve the Preacher, and while he waits, Ferodin thinks about how ridiculous this whole thing is, and how weird it is that Tyakinik suddenly not only got religious, but also into dream interpretation. When the Preacher arrives, neither he nor Ferodin waste any time on pleasantries. Ferodin instead immediately asks about the mask, and we learn that while it is worn, it is basically an extension of the skin. For his part, the Preacher immediately asks to hear the dream that he's here to interpret. Ferodin gets nervous and hesitates a bit, but the Preacher is insistent, and Ferodin gives in. We don't get a full narrative of the dream, but it apparently involves water flowing upward in the well, worlds which were atoms dancing in his head, and the snake which transformed itself into a sandworm and exploded in a cloud of dust. Ferodin finds it especially difficult to talk about this snake bit at the end, feeling a reluctance come over him that he had to fight through to finish relaying it to the Preacher. Once he's done, the Preacher says nothing. After a period of awkward silence, Rodden is basically like, well. And the preacher says, hey, I agreed to interpret your dream, not to tell you about it. Which is just the most infuriating thing imaginable under the circumstances. Maybe this, more than anything, makes me think that this guy is definitely Paul, because this kind of cryptic BS is absolutely the kind of thing that he would do.
Yeah, and just the ballsiness of it.
Yeah, where he's like, oh, well, I said I'd interpret your dream, not that I'd tell you the interpretation. Like, fuck off, man. What an asshole. At any rate, both Faradin and Tyakinik are irate at this revelation, as you might expect. Faradin thinks the preacher is just scamming them for more money, but the preacher reveals that he wasn't paid in money to come here. Despite himself, Faradin is impressed with the man's bravery at being so willing to stand up to him. Tyakinik asks why the preacher won't reveal the interpretation, and the preacher says that, conveniently, the interpretation told him that it would be pointless to reveal it. When they press for more details, the preacher basically says that if he tried to explain, Froden wouldn't understand and would come to the wrong conclusions, which is so condescending, it's crazy. Basically, you're too dumb for me to tell you. Froden asks if the preacher isn't worried about making him angry, and the preacher points out that Froden is already angry, which is a fair point. Tyakinik asks if the preacher doesn't trust them, and the preacher says that this is close, but it's more that he doesn't trust them because they don't trust themselves, which is not very illuminating to either of the Carino faction.
So he's just doing a really good job of insulting them both.
Yeah. He's basically saying, it's your fault that you're too stupid and deluded or whatnot for me to tell you. Which is crazy when you're in the middle of the Carino complex. Tyakinik warned him that he's on thin ice and that men have been killed for less than what he said. However, the preacher couldn't give less of a fuck if he tried, and he does not at all modify his replies to avoid antagonizing them, to the point where Tyakinik wonders aloud whether the preacher is trying to goad them into killing him, which Faradin realizes would make him a martyr and potentially create a very dangerous situation. Faradin asks what value the preacher has if he won't interpret the dream, and, fairly surprisingly, the preacher replies that he has command of Duncan Idaho, who will go wherever the preacher orders him to go. So this obviously raises a number of questions, including whether Duncan knows that Paul is alive, specifically whether he knows that Paul is the preacher, how have they been in contact, or is the preacher just banking on Duncan Idaho having loyalty to Paul above all else, so on, so on. Like, what is their relationship and what does Duncan know, basically? Certainly this could create a potential conflict of loyalty in Duncan, although I guess we have no idea what the current state of Duncan and Aaliyah's relationship is. As a mentat, you would think that he must realize what has happened to her, right? He must see the evidence of abomination.
Yeah, he must be, I mean, he must be able to take all that data and make a calculation.
You would think that if he knows that she was ever in danger of being abomination, and he presumably knows her better than most people, her changes in behavior must be clear to him, you would think.
But what he knows about abomination might not be as much as what others like Paul or Jessica or other people would know, right? Maybe he has kind of limitations on how to interpret that.
But, like, he knows who the Baron is. He knows how the Baron behaves. He knows who Aaliyah is. He knows that she has ancestral memories. If she starts exhibiting even relatively minor barony behaviors, you'd think he'd be able to put two and two together as a mentat.
Mm-hmm.
But
although he knows that the Baron was her ancestor, right? So, does he, actually? Maybe he doesn't. But if he did know that, maybe his assumption would be, oh, like, she's just showing qualities that she would show because she has an ancestor that had those qualities.
Maybe, yeah. I guess it depends on what exactly he knows. So, Faradin is pretty skeptical of this claim to control Duncan Idaho, but Tyakinik tells him that the preacher has many followers on Arrakis, and it could be true. Faradin was unaware that the preacher was from Arrakis and demands to know why he wasn't told about this. The preacher helpfully chimes in to tell Faradin not to feel guilty about Arrakis, as he is but a product of his time, an excuse that any man might make when feeling guilty. Froden unexpectedly finds this amusing rather than getting mad, and tells the preacher that he likes him. Furthermore, Froden wants him to stay here on Seleucus Secundus, continue to interpret his dreams, even if he won't tell him the interpretations, and advise him about Arrakis. However, the preacher says that he can't do this, and Froden gets annoyed again, asking why. Tyakinik explains that when the preacher agreed to come here, part of the deal was that he would be returned to Arrakis. The preacher says that he is summoned back to Arrakis, but won't say by who. Other than that, it is a power greater than either the Carinos or the Atreides. Froden laughs at all this mystical summoning nonsense, and asks why Tiagenic has wasted his time with this. Tiagenic explains that in return for the chance to come here and interpret Farad's dream, the preacher promised to deliver Duncan Idaho as an agent of House Carino, which is definitely intriguing.
Hmm. Indeed it is.
Froden asks why his dreams are so important to the preacher, who replies that the dream has told him that great events move towards a logical conclusion. While he still won't interpret the dream for Froden, he does offer some advice. He basically explains that you can't possibly control everything, and that even the carefully laid plans of government officials, of priests, or of anyone else can be undermined by various random happenstances, like the direction of a breeze, or an unexpected cough, or a bit of dust in someone's eye. In the course of this, he mentions the length of a garment, which piques Tychonic's interest as he wonders whether this is an allusion to the costumes used to train the Laza tigers. The preacher further opines that success requires reducing one's strategy to as small an area as possible, even still, then acknowledging that you can't control all the minutiae. Tychonic asks why he is giving such advice, and the preacher replies that Farad'in is being led to desire a throne, and that while he wishes him good luck, success will need more than just luck. Farad'in's pretty shocked that the preacher would say such things out loud, but the preacher replies that he dares to speak because Farad'in stands at a crossroad. He has the option to become admirable, but he is surrounded by people who focus on strategy rather than on morals. He critiques that Farad'in is tough, but lacks training in other aspects that could evolve his character. Specifically, he criticizes that Farad'in has given no thought to the society he would like to rule if he was successful in taking over. He sees the power of the throne, but has not considered the desires of the people or what a new Carino Empire would look like. So without a more specific plan, he is even more susceptible to the winds of fate, to the unexpected dust or breezes that can shift events. Froden is a bit nonplussed by this explanation, apparently having been taught that morality and social goals were myths that reinforced belief in the forward momentum of humanity and evolution. So basically the general idea of what we read in that Missionary of Protectiva excerpt a few chapters ago, which probably makes sense as having come from his mother. So, seems like Paul is trying to instill the opposite of the Baron's ethos into Farad'in, whereas the Baron is like, morality and justice are stupid. Paul is like, you should at least think about these things.
Yeah.
Or the preacher. I'm sorry, we don't know that it's Paul. Pretty sure it is, though.
So, what do you think the preacher's angle is here? Because he's alluding to a lot of things of the dream, like there's events that are, you know, moving along that are going to their appropriate conclusions. Do you think he's trying to push Farad'in as being, like, a replacement for Aaliyah and maybe bringing the Carinos back to, you know, wipe away the Atreides? Because his preachings have already sort of alluded to, like, bringing down that Atreides religion to an extent, right? Mm-hmm. So it seems like that's his motivation.
Maybe, although it would seem weird that he would work against his children directly. It might just be that he's trying to manipulate all the pieces on the board and get involved in all of the different factions.
Mm-hmm. Try to move them all towards some sort of a direction.
And this is how he's getting into House Carino. Mm-hmm. He gets there, he listens to Farad'in's dream. I don't know that Farad'in would have dreams that have any particular significance. Like,
yeah, maybe he's bullshitting him there.
Yeah, I don't know that that dream means anything, because there's no indication that Farad'in has any kind of like prescient ability. But whatever, it could just be the excuse that the preacher needed to get onto Seleucus Secundus and meet with the Carinos. Perhaps Duncan Idaho is being planted as kind of a double agent, or triple agent or whatever, who's in the Atreides household, but working for the Carinos, but actually really working for the preacher, slash Paul.
Mm-hmm.
So, unclear exactly what the preacher's goal here is, but I do think it's just, my read on it is that, based on what I know now, it's to get himself, I guess, intertwined or with some influence in the Carino side of things.
Right. Yep, that would make sense. And if he can actually get Duncan here, that would also, like, reinforce that, too.
Or at least that they think that Duncan's working for them.
Hmm.
Okay, so Tychonic is super over this whole conversation and asks the preacher if he will fulfill his end of the deal regarding Duncan. The preacher replies that Duncan Idaho is theirs, but cautions that they should use him carefully as he is a priceless jewel, which was so cute.
Oh, adorable.
Ominously, Tychonic says that they have a suitable mission for him, which my best guess is either facilitating the tiger thing, which would be dark, or potentially assassinating Aaliyah, which I could see being their goal. get her out of the way. I guess previously Tychonic said that Jadvid was going to take care of Aaliyah, so maybe that's not it. Who knows? Farradin tells Tychonic to get the preacher out of his sight before he changes his mind, presumably threatening to either kill or imprison the preacher if he doesn't get the fuck out of here. He tells Tychonic that he doesn't like having been used in this way, but the preacher tells him to forgive Tychonic, who is doing God's will without even knowing it. As he watches them leave, Farradin thinks that he needs to look into this new religion that Tychonic is following, and reflects on this odd experience with the Oneiromancer, although he thinks that it doesn't really matter because the dream didn't really matter because it's all bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
Which, after that whole experience, I can totally see him coming away with the, oh my god, I can't believe we just wasted all this time on this conversation. And that's the end of the chapter.
So, one thing, I know we've already talked a lot about some stuff with this chapter, so we probably don't have to deep dive too much at the end, but one thing that I found kind of weird was this whole Tychonic just suddenly becoming religious thing. Like, you find that bizarre, too? I would just think that, like, from Farradin's perspective, it's almost like this, like, person he's known for a while suddenly gets, like, sucked into a pyramid scheme and is like, you know, like, oh, you should join my MLM.
I mean, that's then basically what when Sisha and Tychonic are trying to do, right?
Yeah, it just seems strange, and I guess Farradin is young and impressionable, but it just seems kind of odd that he's, like, getting sucked into that so easily.
Well, that's why I assumed he was much younger.
Yeah.
Because the whole, oh, if Tychonic converts and he does it really publicly and obviously and Farradin looks up to him, he'll want to convert to it too, or he'll at least be intrigued. Like, that makes sense for a 10-year-old, less so for an 18-year-old or 17-year-old, almost 18, but I guess maybe if he is a kind of directionless youth who doesn't really seem to know what he wants and isn't really even set on wanting to be emperor necessarily, maybe it's just an indication that he's kind of on the immature side and doesn't really know what he wants to do. And so maybe he's more impressionable.
Yeah, he could be sheltered, impressionable, naive. There's a lot of possibilities there, I guess.
But yeah, but if I was like 17 and a parental figure suddenly converted to some weird culty religion, I don't think I would be suddenly, like, very interested in it. I would be like, well, that's unfortunate and weird, and then move on with my life, but I don't know.
Any other thoughts on this chapter?
No, other than I'm glad we finally got to meet Farradin and get some insight into what he thinks.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoy his skepticism about this whole Oneiromancy thing.
Yeah.
And the fact that he's, like, I know he's going to look into the religion, and that's kind of the outcome that his mother wanted, but I did appreciate that he was skeptical about the whole conversion thing, and also kind of sees that his mother is really supportive of it, which makes him suspicious. So I definitely appreciate that he seems to be at least somewhat perceptive as a character, and I'm interested to see how much of the plot he knows, how much he's been involved in plotting it versus just kind of being a passive, like, oh, well, my mom and Tychonic are working on this, and, like, if it pans out, I'll be emperor, versus actively participating in the planning, anything like that. And, yeah, ultimately what the preacher's interest in reaching out to the Carinos in this way was.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of, I mean, I feel like a lot of these chapters, we're still fairly early in the book, are kind of setting up the story, so I'm just generally interested to see where the pieces end up falling.
Yeah, fair enough. So at this point, you ready to make some predictions?
Yeah, let's get to it.
Okay, so as we usually do, I have some questions. I also have some character fates you can predict based on who we've met, and a couple characters we haven't met yet. All right, so first question. I think I know your answer already based on conversations we've had and even things you've said in this episode, but do you think the preacher is Paul?
I do. I feel like it would be a giant letdown if he wasn't, because everyone seems to think that he is. On the one hand, you could say for meta reasons, oh, that would be undermining expectations or whatnot, but I just feel like the plain reading is that it is Paul.
Mm-hmm. Like, who else could it be? Like, imagine if, like, it turned out it was Shaddam.
Like, yeah, I feel like it would be a big letdown if it was anyone else. Like, I don't know. Who else would it be that would be interesting?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to say yes, it is.
Okay. Next question. What do you think the state of House Atreides will be at the end of the book?
So I don't know exactly what's going to happen to House Atreides as a whole. I feel like it would be kind of a big letdown if all of the members of House Atreides ended up dying, although it would be kind of fitting given the fact that Paul wants to, or the preacher, who I still think is Paul, wants to tear down the Atreides' legacy. So, I mean, perhaps if this was a standalone trilogy that didn't have sequels, I would be inclined to think that perhaps this is a story of the fall of House Atreides. But because there's at least three more real canon books, depending on who you ask, I'll say that House Atreides is still standing in some form at the end.
Okay. Fair enough. And then same question for House Carino.
That's a little tougher, because this could be the story of them trying and failing to take back power, but it could be interesting if either they do take back power, or maybe things are kind of subverted and we end up getting an alliance. Like, I could foresee... I mean, everyone wants to get rid of Aaliyah, right? So maybe we are able to get a team-up between all the anti-Aaliyah factions. but I can't necessarily see the murdering the twins and getting Faradin on the throne working out, but perhaps Faradin's misgivings about his mother's plots will lead him to abandon her plans and do his own thing. I'll say that House Carino... Okay, how about this? I don't know that I have any broad thoughts about the fate of House Carino as a whole, like its place in the universe, but I think that Faradin will still be around to do something at the end.
Okay.
So, in him, it will survive, but, like, whether the power of House Carino remains intact, I'm not sure about.
Okay, fair enough.
Maybe we can come back. If you want a more specific answer, we can come back to it later, but...
Sure. Yeah, there is at least one more question I'm going to ask you later on, but yeah. We can come back if we feel like that's needed.
Okay.
Okay, so that wraps up our initial questions. So now we have some character fate predictions. So we'll lead off with Leto.
There was that ominous thing about the whole Golden Path plot potentially leading to the death of one of the twins, but I don't know. I can't really see leaning towards one or the other. And they are, like, the main protagonist, and we haven't had a main protagonist die, really, so far. So, I guess I'll say that he and Ghanima are both going to survive.
Okay, because my next question was Ghanima, so I'm assuming...
I figured that. Makes sense to pair them together.
Okay, fair enough. And next, Jessica.
Jessica, I'm not sure about. That's a good question. I think, selfishly, I'm going to say that she survives, because I still have affection for her as a character from Dune. But I don't really have any evidence to back that up at this point.
Okay.
But for now, I'll say she survives.
What about Aaliyah?
Is Aaliyah even Aaliyah anymore? I would love if Aaliyah survives because she gets saved. But at the same time, I feel like there's an awful lot of people working to put her down. So I don't really foresee her surviving.
Okay.
I mean, she's got the Carinos working against her, she's got the twins working against her, she's got Jessica working against her, got the Bene Gesserit working against her. I feel like people don't like her leadership of the Empire, so I would guess that she ends up dead by the end.
Alright, fair enough. Next we have Wincisha.
I hope she dies. We only met her once, but I found her deeply unpleasant. Let's put her in the dead column for... I mean, a lot of these I have no evidence one way or the other for why I think it should go a certain way, so a lot of this is just kind of what I want.
Right.
To some degree, unless I have a good reason for going one way or the other.
Fair enough. And then what about Faradin?
Well, I already mentioned before that I think
Faradin
will survive as the, at least a representative of House Carino.
Okay, so we'll tie those two together then.
And
then what about Tychonic?
I'm not sure. I hope he survives most of the book because I find him at least an interesting perspective into House Carino and their plotting, but I could definitely see him going down defending Faradin or something. Put him in the dead category, I guess. I don't feel like I have enough people in the dead category. You can see I'm approaching this very logically.
Yes. All right, and next, the Preacher.
I wouldn't be super surprised if the Preacher slash Paul, if it is Paul, ends up dead. I feel like that would be, like, a fitting narrative arc. The true rise and fall of Paul Atreides, which we thought happened in the last book, but maybe will actually happen in this book.
The rise, the stumble, and the fall.
Yeah, I could see that. Let's put Preacher in the dead category.
Okay.
Also, I'm pretty sure we got a note that Aaliyah has, like, a price on the Preacher's head, so there's also people out to get him that we know of.
True. Yeah, that's a good point. Then next, what about his little friend, San Tariq?
Oh, I hope this little shit dies.
Are you going to put him in the dead category out of spite?
Yes.
Okay.
Any, like, 12 or 14-year-old kid who goes around happily stabbing people off the chin can jump off a cliff. I understand he's probably been indoctrinated and it's not his fault, but at the same time, I don't know that you come back from that.
Yeah, do stupid shit, win stupid prizes.
Like, I don't know how rehabilitated you can get from, like, gleeful teenage murderer.
Mm.
It'd be one thing if, you know, you had to kill someone to survive and you're able to, you have remorse over it, but he seems pretty gleeful about murdering these people, so, I don't know.
Then next, our favorite ugly lump, Gurney Halleck.
I don't know, he hasn't been in it too much so far, but I would like him to survive. I think it would be nice if he and Jessica got to go back to retirement, so I'm going to say that he should survive.
All right, then Javeed?
I feel like there's a lot working against Javeed in the sense that he's a double or triple agent, and that's just a dangerous position to be in.
Mm-hmm.
Aaliyah is dangerous and formidable. The Carinos are dangerous and he's working with them. He's also working to murder the twins, who are pretty resourceful in their own right. I feel like, or Jessica's got his number because she can tell that he's working against Aaliyah and she wants to try to persuade him to work for her. And so there's just a lot of people who kind of know what's up with him.
Yeah, the deck is certainly stacked against him.
I'd say he's probably unlikely to make it out of the book.
Okay. We'll put him in the dead column. All right, so that's all I had for predictions.
Cool.
So we'll book those and see how they turn out down the line.
Come back in a couple chapters and make some more.
Yeah, we can do that. As we meet more characters and, you know, learn a little bit more about the narrative.
Mm-hmm. We'll probably do at least one more round of predictions at some point.
Yeah, that's usually what we do. We usually do, like, a couple prediction episodes.
Well, and this book is much longer than the previous one, too. Mm-hmm. So, and yeah. We're still fairly early in it, honestly.
Right.
Like, are we even a... We're not even a third into the book, maybe a quarter. Still a lot left to go.
Yeah.
Look forward to getting to it.
Absolutely. Till next time, I'm Alex.
I'm Aline.
Thanks for listening. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Pod Emperor of Dune. If you enjoyed listening to us, we'd appreciate a review on your podcasting host of choice. And be sure to let your friends know about us. You can find us on Twitter under the handle NerdIsayMore, or send us an email at nerdisaymore@gmail.com. If you'd like to support us further, please go to patreon.com/nerdisaymore, where you can also get access to exclusive content.